Hello, listeners. Gary Butterfield here, letting you know that if you are in the Pacific Northwest, my very good band, Modridge, has an album release show on the 2nd, May 2nd, 8 p.m. at The Snug in Portland, Oregon. Great little bar. And it's free. The way we get paid is through drinks. So come on out. If you live in Portland or you live nearby, come check out my band. I'd love to see you. I won't make it weird. You don't even have to say hi if you don't want to. Just want to get some bodies in the bar. So that's Modridge, May 2nd, 8 p.m. at The Snug in Portland, Oregon. Completely free. Album release. Pick up Premier Modridge on modridge.bandcamp.com now. And streaming on Spotify and stuff. My name is Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is Kay Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch. It is our monthly Q&A, listener response, game announcement, thanking Gwen, the Patreon plug. We do all the things.
We do all of it. It's all of it's too many things, honestly.
If you're interested in hearing us plug our Patreon, baby, do we do it at some point.
Yeah. How do you feel about this? Welcome to WAF Dispatch, a celebration of this month in WAF.
Yeah. Are you trying? Are you being serious?
No.
Okay, because I don't want to workshop taglines on air.
No.
But it is a celebration of this month in WAF and a celebration of WAF generally.
Yeah. We can all agree we're here to listen to this show.
Those who hear this sure are due.
So let's get started with the kind of Q&A portion here. We've got game questions. We got a lot of game questions.
Yeah. I'll start this first one because it is a question to you.
Okay.
Clever Clog says, I finally got around to playing and finishing Undertale. I thought it was just the pits, truly irritating and pseudo profound. Gary, I think I recall you being a notable Undertale hater. Nice, by the way. Thanks. Kay, what are your thoughts?
I think it's fine. It's like a solid 8 to me. It was neat at the time. I never read a lot of profundity into it. I just thought it was, you know, fun and cute, and the meta stuff it was doing was interesting, if slight.
There we go.
That's how I feel. Sorry, I can't be more incendiary than that. It's pretty good.
No need to be more incendiary. I think that Clever Clogs and I are in the outliers on this. There's been a little bit of a backlash, but then there's been a forward lash because Deltarune and stuff like that. And then the guy showed the game to the Pope.
Yeah, that was silly. Mama Mia. That was that was kind of silly.
It is a game that it is a struggle that I fail at to not hold its most annoying fans against it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Like the profundity, I think, you know, who knows what the game is actually saying in terms of how profound it is to say that, you know, XP are extinction points.
Yeah.
The X stands for something different. Mm-hmm. If the game is saying that's profound or whether the fans were just blown away by it.
Yeah. I think the characters are fun. That's kind of where I come down on it. I think that the characters are cute.
There's a couple of good jokes in it.
Yeah.
It's like the nicest thing. And it's also a thing where I can admit, I think that if I found it fun to play, I would have liked it a lot more.
Yeah.
I really don't think it's fun to play though.
Yeah.
For me, I don't like the puzzles because they're not puzzles. Mm-hmm. The things you have to do in dialogue aren't something where they give you a piece of information and you're intuiting. That happens a couple times, mm-hmm. but there is a lot of trial and error in it. And then the JRPG replacing the worst half of JRPG, your mm-hmm. one half of the bad half of JRPG, the attack and defend, and replacing it with like a weird little Pico dodging thing is better than nothing, but I don't think it's not a game I'd play on its own either.
Yeah.
And it was super ableist when it first came out. Mm-hmm. It used a shade of blue that was so pale as to be indistinguishable from the white. mm-hmm. which made it really frustrating.
Did they fix that?
Yes.
Okay, cool. That's good.
So good for Pope Man.
Yeah. I'm curious about Deltarune. I never know if all of it is out. That is what stopped me from playing it. Successful Earthbound alikes are rare. You know, you just kind of don't see that super often, even with how popular they tend to be. So, yeah.
Will's really into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's doing also like a meta, doing some meta.
Yeah. Kara writes, what RPGs have been good at getting you to roleplay? I don't mean full RP server, never run a red light stuff, never run a red light in GTA stuff. I mean playing your character in a video game like you would if you were at the table. Personally, I get a lot out of being asked to retroactively fill in my background in relationships and dialogue, or picking from a more defined background like Dragon Age Origins and Original Sin 2 that gives you a solid place in the world.
This is a thing that is, I don't do that often, mm-hmm. I would say. It's hard for me to not be me. Mm-hmm. In a thing. The closest I came to this was Baldur's Gate 3, because when I played it, I had been playing a character actually at the table and decided to recreate them. And that mm-hmm. ended up being a guideline for me.
Yeah.
Like I had spent a lot of time playing as a character, so I was like, okay, I know what this character would do. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the character I wanted to make anyway.
Yeah.
So that kind of worked. So Baldur's Gate 3 would be my answer, for that. A lot of times I can kind of do this, but I never go super whole hog on it for me.
Yeah. I never like make up a character and a background. I just kind of like, I don't know, come up with maybe a gimmick. Like, Fallout games, like Fallout 3 and New Vegas have been this for me. Like I had a real fun time playing New Vegas and saying, all right, I'm going full cowboy. I only want to use revolvers. Right. Mm-hmm. So I just limited myself to those and it was like, oh, that was fun. Like, I'm a gunslinger.
Like you do that and then there's a perk that's like, you want to just use revolvers? Uh-huh. We got you.
Yeah. So I don't get a lot of joy out of like spending a lot of time in the character creator. I have more fun, kind of like Kara said, fitting into an established role. And even that is stuff that's, you know, really slight, like, you know, never taking a rounded corner in RoboCop.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. There's like stuff like that where you actually changes the way you move is really powerful. Mm-hmm. Like that doesn't, I feel like that is pretty rare.
Yeah.
You know, as a thing. It's interesting in like a Dragon Age Origins, because when you have a defined role that it's giving you, I feel like what you will do, the combination between your role being defined and the options it presents you are mm-hmm. fairly limited.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I know what Alistair would do, but the answer is Alistair is not going to ever do anything that interesting. You know, like, and I say this as somebody who like generally likes Alistair. I think it's charismatic performance. Seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's rare that a game has that combination of characters that can have motivations that are complicated enough and then also have verbs or kind of paths you can take that are complicated enough to match. I think it's a hard thing for RPGs generally.
Yeah.
So... Dingle says, hi all, quality aside, do you have any games you would consider formative to you in your youth and how so? While I have my issues with Majora's Mask, it showed me a darkness and surreality that fascinated me as a kid and had a huge impact on my personal taste in art in the years to come. The nightmares it gave me were just DLC. Downloadable nightmares.
Yeah. That there's a lot of this that is just so obvious because we talk about them all the time, but like the quality aside part is the attractive part of this, because I'm trying to think of bad games that nevertheless like had an impact on me. But mm-hmm. I don't know, renting and playing Silent Hill too young was really formative for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I consider that to be a very good game. But that particular moment, that's like one of those convergence points on a timeline, right?
Yeah. Maniac Mansion is my answer if I had for this mm-hmm. on NES, between like having somewhat of a realistic world, like a living mm-hmm. world. The characters had schedules and did stuff. And then also the way that Maniac Mansion specifically pre-Day of the Tentacle, so Maniac Mansion, not Day of the Tentacle, does humor mm-hmm. as this kind of like everything's a little bit off and weird, but it's in comparison extremely subtle.
Yeah.
Like it's not that funny, you know, but it also, it's just everything is a little bit off. That was really big to me for a long time. That influenced a lot of what I liked.
The Mummy, the Hunk-O-Matic, basically just naming things on that one screen. Check the plant. Like, why is this feeding Pepsi? So he's too busy burping.
It's not, you know, laugh out loud funny. It's not jokes like they become in Day of the Tentacle. It's one of the reasons why I prefer Maniac Mansion to Day of the Tentacle, even though Day of the Tentacle is great. Is it doesn't have so much jokes as just kind of a world that is silly in a way that is like appealing to me without being so loud about it. You know, that was a huge influence to kind of like what I was looking for in a sense of humor. Reminded me of Sideways Stories from Wayside School. That is a rare kind of balance of like, you know, I would keep wanting to not say quirky because I don't like that word, but it's like a little quirky, but not like quietly quirky.
Yeah.
It's quirky.
But like, could still be, I mean, like, could like quirky, but scary, you know?
Yes.
Like there's like still,
I don't know. A little mean, too. Yeah. And that was a big Wayside School thing, too. Like a little mean, a little scary, while also being a little silly. Yeah. Like, it didn't feel like it was for kids. You know, that was like, early Nickelodeon was the big Nickelodeon breakthrough. Things also had that, like Ren and Stimpy, stuff like that, where it's like, it's weird, it's funny, but it's also a little mean and a little gross. And that is what I want.
Out of
things.
Yeah. Maniac Mansion is a good answer. That would hit for me. my primary experience with Maniac Mansion was messing around with it way too young, like to really understand it as an adventure game, like with my cousins. But I had that Secrets of the Nintendo Sages book by Russell DeMaria.
God, I love the Nintendo Sages.
Yeah. And there were a lot of just like kind of bare bones walkthroughs in that. Like, this was before I could even read. Like, you know, I didn't have storybooks read to me. I've made my poor grandma read me chapters out of that book. And the Maniac Mansion one was my favorite.
That's great.
let's see. Toby says, Gary has recently mentioned that he's been playing old school shmups, shoot 'em ups. Please recommend some. I've been enjoying the TurboGrafx-16 shmup Blazing Lasers lately, and would like to play more from the genre. If Kay has recommendations too, please don't hesitate.
I haven't gone super deep on this. I have done a couple of them, though. I played through, I can't remember the name of it because they all have silly names, the Super Nintendo version of Cotton.
Okay.
Because I had played the remake of that, or like the re-release of it, and it was good, but I wanted to go simpler. And then I finally, for the first time, played through Guardian Legend, and that's something I have to bring to WoW at some point. Guardian Legend, super cool.
Yeah.
So I'm going a little bit earlier than TurboGrafx right now, but those are all on my list.
Yeah.
It's something when I get an itch, it doesn't take too long because I'm not trying to like master or one quarter any of these things. I'm just getting through them. I'm also not like riding the quick save. So I'm trying to get good at them, but I know I'm not going to be a sicko. I just want this to have a place in my life where I can dabble.
Gradius 3.
Oh, Gradius 3 is great.
I don't remember specifics about it. I couldn't pick it out from other Gradius games. I just assume it's really good.
Yeah, pretty fun.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, I don't know, there's something to it. It's a interesting articulation of an arcade style game because I think it feels more fair than something that is explicitly a quarter grabber to me. Like, even though it has the same kind of like, just sit down and test your twitch reflexes for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. I dig them. JQ says, do you have a game you played well past its sell-by date but just couldn't put down? A few weeks ago I started playing Crimson Desert and have a sizable list of critiques and gameplay issues, but here I am over 110 hours later heading towards the end of the game. Despite the often janky mechanics, flatly written characters, and simplistic but irritating mission designs, frustrating puzzles, and the worst versions of parts of The Witcher 3, Red Dead Redemption 2, Breath of the Wild, and other games it's inspired by, there's clearly some weird itch that's being scratched that keeps calling me back to it like a siren on the rocks. I wouldn't even call it a sunk cost fallacy. I just can't get its dang hooks out of me. I don't have a good answer for this. The stuff I play for fun is more limited. I like to replay games sometimes, so that even limits my pool even further. I play stuff for work, and I have a diseased brain that's like, if I'm not doing homework, I'm not doing anything. And I should go throw myself upon the rocks. So I don't have a good answer for this.
Yeah. This happens to me all the time on streams, but that's just because I don't want to admit defeat on them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's still work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm pretty good if I'm playing something just for myself. If I start hitting those Crimson Desert issues, I'm just kind of like, I'm just gonna let this one fade.
Yeah, it's hard for me to push past stuff.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of that is the job.
Yeah,
like I push back on the idea that like we give things short shrift because of the job. I don't think that's true. I think we pay more attention to things than they ever need.
Yeah,
a lot of the times for the show, but I do think that it does make me for my precious fun play mm-hmm. where I'm like, this character's really irritating. I'm not going to do this.
Yeah, a little bit more discerning with that. Yeah, I use all of my I'm going to push through this energy for stuff for the show.
Yeah. The last thing that I did this, but it wasn't because it had it took to me, it's because out of spite, was when I played Pokemon Sword.
Oh, yeah.
Like a while back. And like that game's got a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of beat it more because of like that was sunk cost. And I was like, I'm pretty far into this. I may as well see how it ends. People have, wrote online this is the best story of any Pokemon game. Mm-hmm. It might, but I mean, is two better than one?
You know,
like out of 10? Like, yes. But it's not like a thing that was actually good.
Yeah,
I would say. What does Naveen say?
Naveen says, you're in the world of Pokemon and need to beat the Elite Eight to become the best, like no one ever was. However, you cannot capture and fight Pokemon, as we have determined that that is barbaric. Instead, you will humanely capture other video game characters to fight for your honor. What six video game characters will fill out your roster? We each get three, Gary.
Okay, yeah, six is a lot.
Yeah.
For that. This isn't the question, but I just want to say that in real life, I would just hit the trainers.
Yeah.
Like they're all kids and old people. Like there's very rare. Every once in a while, there's like a hunk, like an LT Surge, shows up. And I don't think I could beat LT Surge. But I think that if I developed a reputation for like just taking down trainers, I could probably get into his head.
It's so funny. Nobody's ever tried it before.
No. Yeah. You just go up and hit it. It's unsportsmanlike, I guess. Uh-huh. But is it against the rules? I don't know. I just like shirts are cool. And just like get the smack.
Yeah.
Get out of my way and give me all your money.
I'm going to take your bug collection, little kid.
Like I could rule that world. Like just by bypassing the Pokemon entirely and just being like, no, I'm you guys are kids and I'm not.
I kill at the basketball courts at the elementary school.
Yeah. I can buy a weapon for a human.
Uh-huh.
If I was choosing Agent 47.
Okay.
So my third. We'll do a draft. You do. I'll do one. You do one.
Okay. I'm gonna snake one of yours.
That's okay.
Let's say JC Denton.
JC Denton's a real good answer. He'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
At this, I'm gonna say Arkham Games Batman.
Okay. I'm gonna say Kirby.
Oh, Kirby. That's a fun answer. That would be good. Mm-hmm. And then this is just out of affection. I'm going to say Leon Kennedy. I want to hang out with him. And that's half of why you do Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to like, I like this little guy.
You are humanely capturing him.
I would like to humanely capture. What the hell? I would like to, when we played through Resident Evil 9 and then I'm now playing through Resident Evil 4 Remake so Luke can see it.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just getting tons of Leonicules. And mm-hmm. one of the things she and I do is we have like a character version of Leon that lives in our head that we make fun of. And the tip I've been on recently is how he thinks he's like urgently asexual. Like he thinks girls are gross. Like, Leon, kiss me. No thanks. Girls are gross. What's a clit? Just that's what pee comes out of. No way.
Pee comes out of the clit. Yeah, confirmed.
That whole zone, none of Leon's business. I was getting a little Duff Man there for a second, but it's kind of like that. It's been very fun. So
it's good. Yeah. And for the last one, just because we always bring him up whenever characters come up, Kim Kitsuragi.
There we go. Yeah. Kim would be great. He'd be like a psychic type.
Yeah.
Ronald McDonald says, if the WoF creators found a monkey's paw and allowed them to wish to play video games whenever they want with time standing still, what would be the worst cursed outcome? 1, only being able to speedrun NES games. 2, only being able to play MOBAs. 3, only sports games, and specifically only Brian Lara Cricket on the Mega Drive. 4, only video games which don't use a controller. Or 5, Virtual Boy permanently grafted to your skin, Bioshock Infinite Big Daddy style. You can turn the games off, but you still see the world in Virtual Boy vision. Love the show for years. Keep watching out for those fireballs. Ronald.
It shouldn't have been like, what would be the worst? Because like the one that involves grafting.
Yeah, it would be pretty rough. Like the speedrunning NES one, it wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I'm trying to, so like that cricket game, I probably wouldn't like very much.
Yeah.
MOBAs maybe for me. The grafting one would have a big impact on my life, but the Virtual Boy library is kind of good. Like from a video game perspective, I like that more than the only MOBAs. I don't want to play MOBAs.
It's good, but it's limited, right?
It is really limited. Like you'd get sick of those games, but I think slower than I get sick of Brian Lara Cricket.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's probably the grafting one because it would impact the rest of my life, but otherwise I might say the MOBA from a purely video game perspective.
Yeah.
I don't play MOBAs.
Yeah, I'm going to say the grafting one and the cricket. I could probably find something to like in a MOBA.
Yeah. I would enjoy the speedrunning NES games one.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I just playing them. Like, I'm not very good at it. I'm just playing them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But if it was all I could do, I'd probably get okay at them.
Eventually get good at it. Yeah. It'd be fun. Yeah. You could probably become the world record holder and like a bunch of stuff nobody gave a shit about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just knocking down. Like, just roll in there. I speed run Othello for NES.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, finally, cool spot. record holder.
Baron Ames says, I heard this question asked by a listener on the Remap Radio podcast, and I was curious if you two had any interesting anecdotes about this. Have you ever missed a key mechanic of a game? For me, Bloodborne was my first Souls-like game, and I played through my entire first playthrough without knowing there was a run button.
Yeah, this shit happens to me. Mm-hmm. You know, typically if a game does not explain things, I'm playing through RimWorld for the show now. It does not do a good job at tutorializing how and what a bill is.
Yeah.
At all. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to look it up. I'm like, why can't I click on this meat to butcher it?
Mm-hmm.
And like, weirdly, you had to make the table butcher the meat.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, what is the point of, why is that? Like, I'm hitting my stride with it, but it's just very silly.
Mm-hmm.
In Resident Evil 9, there's kind of a cover system.
Yeah.
If you lean or if you're near a corner in first person, mm-hmm. You kind of take cover a little bit. Wouldn't it be that useful for Grace, but would be useful for Leon if you're playing in first person. Mm-hmm. The game does not tell you that. I didn't find out about that until afterwards.
Yeah.
This happens to me for sure.
Mm-hmm. The example that sticks out is when we covered God Hand, which is such a good game. Mm-hmm. But I played through without understanding the upgrade mechanic.
Yeah. Brutal.
Yeah. So I kind of did a challenge run for myself.
It's crazy how tutorials work. Like, I understand it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, but just the people who are playtesting it and making the game are so close to it, things seem obvious to them that are not obvious
yeah.
to the players. And then that ends up going the other way too when something feels over tutorialized. Mm-hmm. You're like, of course I know how to do this. And yeah. I have to then stop myself and be like, no, I didn't know about, this feature in this other game. So it's better that they just tell me.
Yeah.
You know, the tutorial can still be too slow or whatever, but like it is good that it's in there.
Big companies, when they make products, oftentimes they will have somebody who's like not on the development staff, who's just like a technical writer who comes in and does like the documentation for it. Like documentation by the team is always bad. Like tutorials need to be made by somebody who is not close to the project.
Yes. Very much right? So.
Just like, okay, I'm coming in here with a normal set of, just concerned about communicating aspects of this. What questions do I ask the developer? And then how do I sum it up?
That's actually like really good advice for a lot of different creative and kind of like creating things fields mm-hmm. is get somebody who is not your core audience to take a look if you want it to penetrate into Gen Pop.
Yeah.
You know, researching technical things or things around homeownership and maintenance is frustrating to me because, like, there are a lot of assumptions.
Now, parge the lath.
Yeah, there's a lot of that shit. You know, like, do you have what kind of P-trap do you have?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, the dick. I got a dick.
I've got my P-trap as the toilet, and that's what's broken.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it captures it. It's like the Ghostbusters thing. And then if it ever gets loose, New York is fucked. The fucking Slimer's everywhere.
Yeah.
Thickwood Badger says, just chiming in as the seemingly only Red Dead Redemption 2 player who never fed their horse or cleaned their gun. There's zero noticeable gameplay ramifications for it. If you had to make an everyday task a QTE with randomly determined difficulty, what would it be, and what would it look like if you failed? Assume either instant game over or near-death damage. That changes it a lot. That's what it was, I guess that's what it looked like if it failed.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy.
I would say, so you know the yoga mini game from Grand Theft Auto 5? Kind of take roughly that mechanic, bring it to flossing. And in a game, like this would work for like life sim kind of deals. Uh-huh. But also just like imagine like Leon at the beginning of every mission. Like, okay, you have to remember to do this. It doesn't prompt you. You have to go through this flossing mini game. Otherwise, just at random, you'll be taxed a ton of resources for the bill to do your dental work.
Do your dental stuff.
Yeah.
If it didn't say instant game over or near death damage.
Uh-huh.
Like I would, my first thought was flossing as well, but I'm certain that I floss now, but I'm certain I don't do it well enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so like I don't want to die or take near death damage. Near death is pretty intense for flossing.
Yeah.
In terms of it. So there's like I like that answer cause it's fun. But I also, when I try to think about like what I would do because I want to stay alive, I don't know what I would choose. It had to be something I'm really good at.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything I'm that good at.
A few times a week, I do a driving mini game, and that the stakes of that are
that is near death. Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna take yours. I don't have a good answer because I don't feel confident about anything that I can do it with those stakes.
Yeah, very little that I do risk near death.
Yeah,
yeah. Let's see here. Do you want to? We can do some more game questions. Wolfman Fam says, "Hi, Kay and Gary. I loved the 2D platformer genre convo last month, and that may have incepted a related question. I got a Steam Deck recently and had a hankering for a 3D platformer, or at least I thought I was. After searching around, I picked up and started Psychonauts 2. Certainly a 3D platformer by many definitions, but so much more linear and story-driven than the Mario Odyssey-like that I was picturing in my head. In fact, maybe rather than thinking, I'm craving a 3D platformer, I should have thought, I'm looking for an experience similar to Mario 64 or Odyssey or whatever. My question is about genre as a concept. How much of what we think of as genre is today better expressed by the suffix like, your roguelikes, souls-like, and the like, do you think genres are more useful as a collection of traits that a game might have, or if genres work better as things that share DNA with other things? Either way, it's all subjective.
Yeah, I think neither are sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Souls like, you know, describing Metroid Dread and describing Lords of the Fallen already kind of shows like that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that doesn't, there's some things they have in common. I think the idea we need to put a nail in the coffin of like, you like a genre.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't, you know, like it's more like you like certain subsets of a genre and certain games from it. We just need to be not afraid of using more words.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't have to pretend like we're classifying things at a blockbuster.
Yeah,
that's for other people to do, and then it's for us to do additional looking into.
Yeah,
you know, broad categories are useful just literally as a first step, but it can never be an only step on either end. It just doesn't work.
We had a whole involved topic discussion, I forget how long ago, just about genre.
Early, and, I think it was an early dispatch.
It would have had to have been because it comes up. You know, people like talking about genre. People like doing gotchas about genre.
Yeah,
but it's like, you know, separating subject matter from interaction model. Yeah, I think like the, you know, it really just kind of gets down to if you like X, then you will like small list of things.
Yeah,
and then there's that.
Like, you know, or you might like, you know, because you end up with genre things where you end up with things like, you know, you might like a game that is very similar to something else, but you don't like the fantasy of that.
Yeah.
Or you're just not interested in it. That happens with me with things where it's like, oh, this is military flavored.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just not that interested in military flavored stuff.
I was going to say, like, I like first person shooters. They're just fine. I will play a first person shooter. I like sim games. I'm not going to sit down and play Arma.
No, it's completely, you know, yeah, everything is too complex to do this with.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That applies, you know, it comes up with us for games, but I think this is also largely true for music and movies and such, depending on how sensitive you are. Mm-hmm. Games, because they have a subject matter and interaction model, they have multiple axes mm-hmm. for this that are more clearly like evident. It's even more needs to be refined.
There's an anxiety around it, I think. I'm not going to project on everybody else, but I have this kind of feeling where, like, just describing everything in terms of its nearest neighbor, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of like this. Like, if that is the way that games broadly are conceived of, say, like, everybody suddenly started describing them that way, right? Mm-hmm. The anxiety that I sometimes feel is that, like, okay, if that was the way everybody thought about games, then that would really limit the amount of possibility that we would have for a new game to be, if every game had to start with another game as its, you know, kind of like closest comparison point.
I get that as a thing on the talking about it stage, but I don't think anybody's creating games is thinking that way.
Yeah, and I don't think so either.
You know, we're talking about The Last Spell recently, which is a game that is made up of component parts.
Yeah.
Like, I can't think of another game that's exactly like that, but it takes a lot of little bits mm-hmm. from stuff. And I, you know, that game has a lot of care into it. It's extremely deep. There's a lot of mm-hmm. vision to it. You know, the person who made it was not thinking in a limited term.
No.
You know, they just, yeah. So mm-hmm. I think about that though too, Lo. But it is also a thing where that's a part where like art runs into commerce, where like to a degree that is clue, like to a degree the game industry, to a degree, nobody mm-hmm. yell at me, the game industry is limited in a way that does meet demand. Mm-hmm. Like, we can get into discussions about discoverability and such like that, and then art for art's sake. I believe games are art. You should make art for art's sake. But there's a reason why the Ubisoft model is big, why you can say, oh, it's basically Far Cry, the end.
Yeah.
It's because those games sell. They have a core audience. People like them, mm-hmm. you know, and then you start getting into, like, do they really like them, or are they just being fooled? Like, they really like my Ludum Dare thing about, you know, a coffee shop for frogs, if they knew about it. And I have skepticism around that. Like, it's really fucking messy as a thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's a degree, though, to which there is kind of a bell curve of taste, like for folk, and the most games will hit that. And as that has kind of a dominant mode, which changes, mm-hmm. you know, as time goes on. There was a time where it was all like Doom clones, right? Like as that changes as time goes on, we are going to get a little bit less innovation in that space. And where we need to be looking for innovation and resting assured that it exists is on the other sides of it.
Yeah.
You know, I get frustrated with people who get mad at Gen Pop for doing Gen Pop ass shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh, this game is so amazing. Why on earth doesn't everyone love it? And I'm like, because it's a personal story about, like, walking home at night. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not why most people play video games. It can be incredible and you can wish the world was like that. Mm-hmm. But just know your audience at least a little bit. Like, it's probably not going to take the world by storm the same way that, like, you know, the Residents or Devo aren't going to take the world by storm outside of a couple exceptions.
Yeah.
I'm expecting people to be way into Devo's album Shout like I am. It's really iconoclastic. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything has its place.
Yeah. Everything has its place. And it's okay. You know, nothing bad is happening if you like a thing and it's not super popular. It sucks for the industry money wise. Mm-hmm. But then the answer to that is make cheaper games.
Yeah.
You know, put less investment in up front.
This is just bringing to mind that in certain markets, Synecdoche, New York was marketed as a comedy.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is very funny if that's intentional.
Yeah. Very good. Luke says, hi, Gary and Kay. If you could each will a game into being, an entry in an existing series or something brand new for the other host, what would be the perfect gift game for them? That's fun. Yeah. I feel like we've been asked a variation of this before. Mm-hmm. Not calling Luke out. It sounds familiar to me.
X-Men Immersive Sim.
Yeah. X-Men and Sim's a really good answer. For you, I think I would give you a roguelike where the runs take 10 hours and we have to do it for the show because I'm dying. it's my dying wish. No, I don't think I would do that. It's difficult because you play a lot more games than I do. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of the games that I would will into existence for you try to find through Hexcrank. stuff. Yeah. I think I would probably, this is kind of a softball and it's not that notable. But it's also a little self-serving. I'd tee up another Crow County, like another, this is a classic survival horror with all of the, you know, that just works really well. Yeah. Really streamlined, good story, really charming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crack of the bat.
Yeah.
Give you a Crow County.
Hole in one. Yeah.
Yeah. Very safe gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd appreciate that. Mm-hmm. David writes, how often do you engage in post-game or new game plus content and games that you're just playing for fun? Also, if it's something you do, what style do you enjoy the most? Example, like RE style unlocking cheat codes, Dark Souls style, play the game again, but only slightly harder, or games where beating the final boss unlocks a bunch of new content.
For me, not very much. Mm-hmm. When I replay Dark Souls, I've only played through Dark Souls New Game Plus once. I didn't care for it that much. Mm-hmm. It's fine. I'd much rather play with a different build or even a challenge build if I want to up the challenge. And then for Resident Evil games, I like replaying Resident Evil games, but by the time I'm doing it, I've waited long enough that I just want to play it again as it is.
Yeah. My problem with the Resident Evil, like cheat code kind of things, like, yeah, maybe sometimes you get a better, you know, you get a gun, like right away. I think that they're well enough designed that I do not want to have something that disrupts the curve, or those things are sometimes that they get rid of a mechanic that I enjoy. So like when I replayed nine for the show, I played in casual, but also I used my combat points or whatever challenge points, to buy a, unbreakable knife for Grace. And that just gets rid of a whole side of the economy for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can understand the idea of doing that for just wanting to breeze through a thing, but that just comes to there being a lot of games to play, you know, for me. I do kind of do this for roguelikes, I suppose. Like I'll go past the end game. But those are a little bit different because they're like activity spaces. It's not really a game with a beginning and an end. Exotic Minivan says, after just listening to the Bioforge Abject Suffering and hearing about the 1001 essential games list, what would be some essential games that you think people should play in their lifetime? We gotta play Bleep Bloop Pac-Man. Gotta play Tetris.
Yeah. You gotta play the Governor Spilled His Tea on Specky.
Yeah, you gotta play ZX Specky, Governor Spilled His Tea. Rascals on ZX Specky. You gotta play the case of the port murder or whatever on Japanese microcomputers. I bet you that list is actually one half pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it's the foundational stuff. And then for me, it would be like picking out a game that does the thing that you want to, and not having that much overlap.
Yeah.
You know, and you had to think about like whether your audience or you as a author of the list care about history, right? Like, you know, I can see an argument for you play Super Mario Brothers and you play Super Mario World. I can also see an argument for you just play Super Mario World.
Yeah.
As the apotheosis of that platforming model.
Yeah. Like how much you care about history also works. Cause I was thinking like, you know, I think that a person would not have engaged with the best of video games if they didn't sit down and play Hitman World of Assassination.
Yeah.
Right. Like that feels like a must to me.
It's a thing go ahead.
Yeah, but like, you know, somebody could say, well, you know, why not Blood Money? And I could give a number of reasons for why that is. Like, if you're giving this to somebody to do now, you know, I feel like World of Assassination kind of obviates Blood Money, you know, having played it now. Yeah.
It'd be a thing where it'd be how many we list, you know, and it'd be my first instinct is to find the exemplar from each like micro genre.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be Blood Money, you know, but Blood Money would not necessarily take the point, like the place of Deus Ex, even though they both have MSIM stuff. It would not take the place of Baldur's Gate 3 or Divinity Original Sin 2, you know, for that. Like, but the kind of the, like, my instinct would be to ignore history because it's somebody should play something in their lifetime and time is precious. And I have no idea how old this person is.
Yeah.
They might not have that much time left. Just finding the exemplar of the micro genre.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be kind of a fun topic at some point, but we'd want to have preparation.
Yeah.
Like exemplar of the micro genre is a fun idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on that?
No, not that I can think of.
It's interesting thinking about that specifically between Resident Evil and Silent Hill of old school, mm-hmm. because they are different.
Yes.
You know, like there are different micro genres and stuff, but the degree of sensitivity is interesting to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, you know, again, it just depends on how many there are. And it's like, okay, if you're picking the exemplar, are you also getting rid of like the first or like something that bridges two things?
Yeah.
Because like, you know, my list of games that somebody should play would include Ultima Underworld, right?
Yeah.
That is a very good game on its own, but it's also super interesting as a bridge between Dungeon Crawler and Immersive Sim, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So very, you know, a difficult question. Mm-hmm. We were pretty hard on that guy who wrote that book.
Yeah.
Rightly so, because we did come up with better answers in this 2 seconds.
or at least a better modality for it.
Yeah, better modality for it. Like we actually came up with a premise for it.
Yeah.
We set out with a mission statement. Matt Bixler, hello. moving on to life question says, do either or both of you know where the toothpicks are in my house? I would have bet anything I just bought some, and it only really makes sense that they'd be in the kitchen, but I can't find them anywhere. Is this one of those things where I think something that happened last week was like 6 months ago, or did my girlfriend have some use for them and now they're somewhere I can't possibly predict?
Yeah. It's so weird that we keep toothpicks in the kitchen when we should keep them next to the floss.
Yeah, or like the dining room, I guess. Like you want to pick your teeth right after you eat.
Yeah,
as a thing. I'm going to throw in a third option here. You left them at the store, or they're in your car.
Yeah, they're in your car. Like you left them, like it fell out of the bag, and they're in the cart now. That has happened. Yeah,
yeah. They never made it into your house.
Yeah.
So,
where do you keep your toothpicks?
I don't. Toothpicks don't work for me. I just use floss.
Okay.
I keep floss in the bathroom, but toothpicks. My gums are better now that I've started flossing, but my gums being sensitive because of a lifetime of bad dentistry made me gun shy about toothpicks for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. I keep toothpicks around in case I need them for like a little project. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you need to, you know, clean like in between, you know, just not your teeth, but get it in a tight space. But for my teeth, I have floss picks.
Yeah,
I got best of both worlds.
Yeah, I use floss picks as well for floss.
Yeah.
Let's move on to media questions.
Yeah. John says, hey, folks, despite rarely writing in, it occurred to me that I've been listening to Duckfeed shows now for about 10 years. Scary. It's made me think about the idea that our lives are fundamentally made up of the things that we engage with regularly, our habits, the things which blend into the fabric of our day, week, or month. My question is, what have been your core media habits for the last decade? Which things have withstood the test of time? Cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for the support. Mm-hmm. I watch YouTube over breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably been at least 10 years that I've been doing that. That is a daily ritual for me. It's just stupid enough and not engaging enough that I don't need to bring anything to it.
Yeah. That seems like a really nice way to start the day, honestly.
It's really easy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I want easy in the morning.
Yeah. So for me, it's like, it's hard because of all like the rewatching and stuff is the primary way I do non-show media. I started listening to the Majority Report about, 2018 or so. And I've listened to that every day since, pretty much. It's a good show. Very funny. You know, it is, you know, exposure to news. As far as like a regular fixture, always look forward to that coming out, hearing a real cool, informative interview, and then, a bunch of, clowning on, you know, conservative dipshits.
Yeah. Marius says, hey, y'all, since Tube Talking is somewhat canceled, I want to hear your opinion on some recent videos I've watched that seem very Duckfeed coded. One, friend of the network, Yamfa, released a level 1 honor mode Baldur's Gate 3 playthrough in the usual chaotic style of his FromSoft challenge run, and it's really great. Kay, have you seen the ContraPoint's recent essay on the morality of the Saw franchise? Also quite great. Best wishes.
Have you seen the Yamfa one?
I know that it exists, but I have not watched it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I have watched that ContraPoints video.
Oh.
The Yamfa one is in my watch later just for when I have time I want to sit down and watch it.
Yeah, yeah. No. I have not seen the ContraPoints one. I'm curious about it. It sounds like a fun topic for a video. I would like to see how she chose to present it.
It's good. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there are people who have problems with her. I don't want to get into any of that.
Yeah,
you know, so just disclaimer, you know, if you, I know.
Yep.
But the, so she kind of starts off with like a defense of them and then kind of dials it back. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to pretend these are good movies to make mm-hmm. this point, and then makes an interesting point.
Yeah.
About it. And it's a lot about, like viewership. Mm-hmm. It's a lot about, whether, you know, audiences finding or identifying with morality in media.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Yamfa one's on my list. Thank you for reminding me of it.
Yeah.
What does Alex say?
Moving on to show questions. These aren't really questions. They're just comments. But I think they're worth reading aloud. Alex says, no question. Just wanted to say that this run of guest episodes since last year has really been a delight. It's normally something that even people I love to listen to manage to flub since it kills the energy. But every last one of these new ones has been a delight. Thanks.
Yeah. And then the other question, comment is similar. I wanted to commend Liv's appearance on the show. She did a great job. I can't wait to hear more of her.
Stay away from my wife. people really like the Liv's guest spot.
You know what? I learned how to pick them. Mm-hmm. It took a long time, but I finally got it.
Yeah.
I'm really glad everybody liked it. Mm-hmm. I was a little nervous about it because I thought the notes were like a departure,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was like, can this support this?
Yeah.
You know, but I was not nervous about her because she's great.
Yeah.
And I like these too. I like the Isaac episode we did. Mm-hmm. I've liked having this on the table.
Yeah.
I like that there's like something like 4 unclaimed slots for the rest of the year and 2 of them I don't have to do.
Yeah.
So I get to play something fun just for Gary during that time.
Yeah. You
know? I like these and I'm glad people had a good response to them because they're necessary. Like they, mm-hmm. we didn't do these as like a, hey, won't this be cool? We did this as a, we need to be able to find a way to take some game time off from time to time
mm-hmm.
Without just doing that work on either end of the time off.
Yeah.
Here's one way we can do it.
Yeah. And I think that it helps that like we know and have rapport with the people that we're having yeah. on.
We got a bench.
You know? Yeah. We have a, you know? Yeah. You know, like it was really fun having Ben on to talk about Satisfactory. That is a weird game to talk about, but I think he added a lot. And then Bob obviously is great. He is very mm-hmm. knowledgeable about Majora's Mask. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we got good banter. So
it's having a bench is really nice compared to when we had guest episodes on Bonfires, I'd chat more frequently mm-hmm. and such, which like I know that a lot of people have a lot of affection for that. And I think there's killer episodes
yeah.
in that. Like, you know, again, speaking of the last question, like I really liked getting a chance to talk to Yamfa, mm-hmm. for example. But using people who we know already, like the network, kind of like a charisma first network in some ways. Like, I don't think that we're not smart or anything like that, but we do want to be charming and quick paced and funny.
We're both broken in that particular way.
Yes. We want to make waitresses laugh.
Yeah.
And that is easier with people, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, and again, not that I'm also not saying these people don't have great insights. I'm also not mm-hmm. saying that we don't have great insights. I'm just saying that, having a known quantity, here's another way to say it. We both have anxiety disorders and talking to a known quantity is a lot easier.
Yeah.
There's a way to talk about it. it doesn't feel like bragging. So. Let's do some lightning round.
Let's lightning it up. Bert writes, dear Kay and Gary, your podcast network seems to have the momentum of a runaway freight train. Please tell us, why are you so popular?
We're a personality-based network. We don't have mm-hmm. tons of insight, but we both have an anxiety disorder. I think we... Talking Simpsons gets this constantly.
Uh-huh.
I feel good to have finally gotten this reference aimed at us.
Yeah, that's so thank you, Bert. Thank you for filling that.
Bo says, lightning round question or lightning RE question? Resident Evil question. Lightning yeah. Resident Evil question. Best boss, best location, best second character section. Mine would be Marguerite in the Greenhouse, the police department in Resident Evil 2 remake, and at the Ashley section in Resident Evil 4 remake.
Yeah.
This is tricky. Best boss is hard. Because
they don't do very good bosses.
They don't for a long time. Like they were pretty bad at it. Marguerite's a good answer. Marguerite is really good.
Yeah.
I think I really liked the Mr. X fight in Resident Evil 9 quite a bit. And I like Krauser in the remake a lot.
Yeah, Krauser remake was gonna be mine. Yeah, actually.
That's really good.
Yeah. And that's just a Metal Gear boss fight.
Yeah, but like with not Metal Gear controls.
Yeah.
You know. And then I'm gonna say the village in Resident Evil 4, my favorite location, the individual, like that whole stretch with the farmhouses and everything is really great. But if I had to nail it down to one like arena, that village is so fucking iconic and good.
Yeah.
And showed me a new thing games can be.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
I'm not going to pick an obvious one for this. I'm going to go by impact. And this
the
is
the train from RE0. The train is the only good part of that. I couldn't remember any of the other parts though. So that's how damning that is.
Yeah. There's a bat hallway.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I could say Spencer Mansion. That is the holiest space to me. But I'm going to say in terms of like impact that it had on me, I still, every time I go into the guardhouse in Resident Evil 1, I feel exactly like I did when I first went there. And suddenly I'm dealing with spiders and bees, like it's taken over by the hornets.
I love the guardhouse.
Yeah,
the guardhouse rules so hard. And then my second favorite secondary character part is kind of tricky for me in that I don't generally like these that much. Like I like that they're there for texture, but I think they're rarely that fun.
They're not really like standouts.
The Ashley section in Resident Evil 4 remake is good. The Sherry section in Resident Evil 2 remake is good. Is better. The Ada Wong section in Resident Evil 2 remake is okay.
Yeah,
I don't know. I guess that might be my one because I remember that doing some interesting things. I generally think these are a weird kind of gimmick that I don't necessarily love.
Yeah. I was gonna say Ada.
Original Ada or remake Ada.
Remake Ada.
Yeah.
Michelle writes, "Hey Gary, hey Kay, possible topic prompt for this month, flag on the moon. How did it get there?"
We put it there.
Yeah, no, the Russians did. The Russians beat us to the moon, but they hit it.
In that fiction.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In real life, though, just we put a flag on the moon.
Yeah, we saw there was a guy who put it there.
Did all the things you can do on a moon.
Yeah.
Randall says, "Mary fuck kill Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, Alice in Chains." I'm really disappointed, and we need to like rerun the
that it wasn't seven Mary three
Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, Alice in Chains would be a great sentence that I can parse.
Yeah,
like that has an answer, but it would be seven Mary three Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, Alice in Chains.
That's a shibboleth right there.
It's like I recite to myself every night before bed for go to sleep.
Yeah, it's not dissimilar to like that buffalo 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 sentence.
Yeah, very much so. I'm going to marry Pearl Jam. They seem at least scummy to me.
Yeah.
And there are at least a couple Pearl Jam songs I'm okay with.
Yeah, they're steady.
Yeah.
That's my answer for Mary as well.
I'm going to kill Stone Temple Pilots. Learned just a lot about Scott Weiland recently on Slop YouTube.
Okay.
That guy sucks.
Yeah.
Did you know, so that guy died of drugs.
Yes.
You know, which I'm sure you knew. Did you ever read or know about the open letter his wife wrote to Rolling Stone?
No.
It's like the most brutal eulogy of all time. It's basically like, if anything can kill the like drug addict rock star lifestyle mythos, this should be it. Do not romanticize this. This is a man who forgot his children's birthdays, who did this, and just like listed a big litany of things that like he did because he was an addict. And like he's not, and she's like, I understand addiction's hard, but I spent, you know, a decade like trying to get him help. At one point, he tossed himself out of a moving car to avoid going to rehab.
Oh, my God.
Which is, like, again, I understand addict behavior. Like, we've all seen that episode of Review. But, like, just, man, the guy had kids and stuff. I think that's always my line for how self-destructive you can be. Like, you have kids, stop doing it.
Yeah.
Like, you have kids, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that leaves fucking Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
Which, for me, is a lady name, so I guess. And, like, bondage. Sure.
Yeah. I was going to go the other way around, like, not taking the, just thinking of the music, I guess. Stone Temple Pilots like does weird stuff. Alice in Chains is some of the most boring music I've ever seen.
Alice in Chains does make me want to kill myself.
Yeah, it's also slow.
It's so slow. Like, coming end of spring, future CIA torture songs. You might find a little Seven Mary 3 in there. Uh-huh. Speaking of songs, are like 80 Ooh. BPM for no reason.
Yeah. This doesn't have the actual grunge answer, which is Screaming Trees. So, oh well. Videogames.Afghanistan says, lightning round, just for K. What is a McMenamins?
This is very funny. Videogames.Afghanistan is a funny person.
Yeah, very funny. Thank you. I feel like I've driven by one. It's like a restaurant?
Yes, but more.
Okay.
Tell me more. Like, yes, but that's not the answer.
Okay. So, like, more specific than just a restaurant.
I wouldn't say more specific.
Oh.
I'd say less specific.
What? Is it like an Applebee's? Like, is it like a local, like, chain we're a good time bar and grill kind of thing?
I'll give you, it's a regional chain.
Okay.
I'll give you that for when we say local chains, regional chain.
Okay.
No, keep going. Like this is the fun. This is the game that they set up.
Okay.
What else do you know about McMenamins?
Let's see here. Well, there's a Mick in there. Is it Irish?
No clue.
No.
No. Not important to the answer. Oddly enough.
Yeah. No. I have no idea. I mean, other than a restaurant and bar, I don't know what to say.
It's because it's really weird. McMenamins is a regional chain of institutions, oftentimes have a restaurant, but almost never just a restaurant. It's a music venue, movie theater, set of bars, activity space, public swimming pool, hotel. It's whatever they can do, because the McMenamins concept is they take cool old buildings and put these things in them. So it's kind of whatever the building can fit.
Okay.
So there's a school that is a McMenamins, and this has a venue in it and a hotel and a pool and like six bars and a restaurant and a movie theater where it's the school like play or the school auditorium that's all couches.
We talked about doing a meetup at one of these at some point, right?
Yeah. There's one that's basically just a theater. Like a lot of them are theater restaurants. A lot of them are bar restaurants. It's kind of a bunch of stuff. They serve really, really bland food.
I'm sure
that some people in Oregon for some reason are affectionate to, like the country folk in Oregon, like people who are not from the city, like, oh yeah, McMenamins, this is fucking good. Yeah. And then everybody I've ever met who has ever lived in the city is like, well, why would I fucking eat this horrible burger?
Yeah, it just looks like, you know, American pub cuisine.
Yeah, very much so. I guess they are kind of Irish. I was at one once and there were fucking bagpipists playing, which is like, hey, do you want to think or talk? You can't. The thing about McMenamins that's cool though is like the products they have and stuff suck, but it's like you get to go explore a school.
Yeah,
it's kind of fun. Like you go into a bar that's in the boilers room, in the boiler room, stuff like that. Cool. Like that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Like I am generally in favor of them. There used to be one across from PCC when I was going to community college that was in a chapel, and it was just a restaurant, but it was a restaurant that was an old chapel, so it looked cool.
That's cool. Yeah. Sounds fun. Uh-huh.
It is just a weird thing. And there's also, to confuse things even further, there's McMinnville, which is a town like outside to the west.
Any relation?
I think so, but I'm not totally sure.
Huh.
It's really complicated. It's a weirdly, you know, when I said it wasn't more specific, it's less specific. Like it's a broad.
So that's why it was funny. Like you did kind of a
Thank you for I did the Muttley laugh at that because it's like, yeah, it's a funny question. It went from a smaller, louder voice to a larger, quieter one.
Oh yeah.
Drew says, hi, Gary and Kay. Do either of you listen to the OCs or OCs? If so, what do you think of them? Thanks.
No.
Yeah, not super familiar. I think that they are generally, I think they're good ones, if I recall. Is that the band that does that really good song from the Salute episode of Breaking Bad?
Oh, I don't know.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that song's great.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that song a lot. Tidal Wave is the name of that song, and that song rules.
Okay.
But I haven't gone deep on them.
Yeah. It is news to me that they were in that episode of Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the way as Gus poisons everybody.
Yeah.
That's the thing that plays as everything's going to shit.
Nice. Max writes, if your pets had an inner monologue a la Homeward Bound / Look Who's Talking Now, what actor would provide the voice?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
I don't know. We kind of do, I think like Jessica might be like a Shelley Duvall
mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. And Pocket, I, you know, understand he's canceled. I'm just the question of the voice. It'd be Justin Roiland because Pocket makes lemon gram noises all the time. Like he does a lot of that kind of thing when he's stressing out or he wants water or wants something. Mm-hmm. So we always say he's lemon grabbing.
So he's lemon grabbing.
Yeah. So it'd be like something very demure. You know, and kind of soft, and then Justin Roiland.
Yeah. For Dottie, because she is so skittish, I picture her as kind of a like a Maria Bamford.
Okay.
Yeah. Who can kind of bring like a nervous energy to things. And Greta is hard because for as like dignified as she looks, she is real like needy food wise.
Yeah, she's a food goblin.
Yeah, she's a food goblin. So like anytime I stand up, she like tries to lead me to where she thinks the treats are. Yeah. I started moving the treats around the house. So there's no association. No, just because like at the old house, she knew exactly where the treats were and that's where she tried to lead me. Mm-hmm. Now she's just vaguely like needy about, yelling at me. So it's hard to think about who would do that.
It's hard to think about it without making like a fat joke.
Yeah.
Like you don't want to say like Louis Anderson, who made his career talking about like wanting food and stuff. Like he owned it. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to, first of all, it'd be weird to talk like Louis Anderson. That's uncomfortable. Yeah. Be a sonic nightmare.
You know what? I'm going to say Tina Fey.
There you go.
Yeah.
Eric says, if you could be a flesh transformer and transform into any other object, what would it be? And what would your transformer name be? There's a lot of assumptions in this question about flesh transformers. I know what that means, but there hasn't been one.
No.
You know, I don't have an example I can point at. Like the closest thing is Jason the Wheeled Warriors or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or not Jason the Wheeled Warriors, Turbo Teen. Turbo Teen is a flesh transformer, but he turns into metal. Mm-hmm. He's not made of flesh once he transforms.
Gary, I have an answer for this.
Okay.
Yeah, I like being of use. I like being helpful. Mm-hmm. What is something that usually comes in handy, but not a lot of people have ready access to? A ladder. Also, the transformation sequence for a human turning into a ladder and the idea of a flesh ladder is bone chilling.
Yeah, flesh ladder is really tough because the bones would have to be, you'd have to have enough femurs to make the horizontal struts.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves the vertical ones all gooey. Like there's not enough bones for a flesh ladder.
Yeah.
Like too many bones are too small.
It'd be like
a ladder, like a chain. Like you'd use femurs for the sides and then the inside would be little chains of your bones and stuff, I think, almost. Yeah.
I'm not thinking about the logistics. I just think it would be useful / horrifying.
It'd be really gross.
Unsettling, yeah.
Yeah, really a boy in his blob. Like it can do that.
Yeah. You know,
become like licorice ladder or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think of something that I would use. Like I don't necessarily want to be of use to people because like when I think about ladder's a good answer because it elides this. But when I think about like, oh, everyone likes a chair, mm-hmm. you get into like pervert shit. Like, you know, and I don't want to be a flesh chair that people sit on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as a thing. So I'm trying to think of something I would like to be. That'd be useful. And I think that I might want to be just a cube for storage. Like, if I could be a cube.
That's so long-term, though.
It doesn't have to be. It could be just for overnight.
Oh, okay. No. So, like, all right. Not a cube for people to store things in.
Oh,
like,
you want to
turn into a cube.
Yeah, I don't need other people to use me in this scenario.
Okay.
I'm not interested in being out of use. I'm thinking of this purely selfishly.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to be able to fit into spaces like that. I guess maybe a flesh transformer that turns into that, or maybe I could slip under doors.
You want to turn into that girl from that one drug PSA?
Like, yeah,
flattens you out. Yeah.
Or like a centipede.
Mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah. And then name wise, what would be your cool Transformer ladder name? I'm Flatpak.
Okay. So, okay. Reacher.
Okay. Flatpak and Reacher. This is a good idea. Don't draw it. Everybody. Like, whatever you do, please don't fucking commit this to paper.
Yeah. Yeah. Ben writes, lightning round. I recently played Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. What is the most maddening, worst-paced game you've ever played?
Maddening, worst-paced game I've ever played. It's hard because we used to tap out of stuff.
Yeah.
Sword of Mana made me want to fucking die.
Yeah.
Like, I could not handle that. And then I think about Golden Sun.
Mm-hmm.
That game is really poorly paced. Every character has to say a little quirky thing after every single line, and it's all just saying, yes, absolutely, let's do it, we'll go, I'll try my best, after every single fucking thing that happens in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
That is maddening. Yeah. It kills the pacing.
I don't have a ready answer for this. I'm trying to think of like one that stands out. Sort of Mana. Yeah, we really did just stop tapping out of things, didn't we?
Yeah. We started the Patreon. Yeah. I think is part of it. Like, it started feeling worse. Mm-hmm. When we were just doing this for free, and it was like, I don't know. I can't do this, but we stopped tapping out of stuff.
Yeah. I'll say this and be controversial. Boy, is Fatal Frame 2 paced really weird and badly.
Is that controversial?
people fucking love that game.
I know that your arc recently has been you not liking it and trying to like it.
Yeah.
But I'm not very familiar with the popular opinion of Fatal Frame.
Yeah, the popular opinion is people, the horror in it really, really works for them, and they don't seem to mind. Basically, every sin that survival horror has ever been accused of is embodied in Fatal Frame 2. Like, I actually found them. I found where they're at, where they actually are. You run so slowly. You go through the same places that look very similar several times. The signaling is very bad. You're constantly just kind of like being knocked over and stunned. Kind of deals. Yeah, I would say Fatal Frame 2.
A nonstop being interrupted and stunned is like a thing that we're seeing in lots of games. Like, we're noticing it.
Yeah.
It feels like Dead Space 2 kind of awakened, like we put on the They Live glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh boy, games sure do like to put you into an unskippable animation.
Yeah.
Moving on to our topic for this episode, Kellerak asks, in the WoF episode on mouthwashing, there was some brief deliberation about how fandom-driven the game reputation seemed to be online, with how heavily the game seemed to be merchandised, and with how much of its fandom share fan art, and there being a lot of discussion around shipping characters. I've been thinking a lot about fandom in general lately. While fandom isn't a new thing culturally, and especially not on the internet, how it has presented itself feels like it's changed after the 2010s, with certain media properties being very closely linked to people's personal identity. While this isn't necessarily new, I feel like it has certainly blown up and become more mainstream to the point where there exist media properties that seem ready-made for fandom. How we talk about fandom in general is largely in the negative, I find, as larger discussions about it seem to be focused on how annoying or weird a certain fandom is, i.e. Undertale. A nice little bit of synergy there. Mm-hmm. As folks who have been in online spaces long enough to see these changes unfold, I was wondering if you had any thoughts about it. Do you find it to be a worthwhile way to express your identity, or do you find it to be a nuisance that people get too wrapped up around to what is ultimately just consuming products? Are there any fandoms you participated in now or in the past? Thank you for the amazing work you do. Thank you.
Yeah. This is not new. I remember back during like the Dark Souls 2 season, when we were talking about what would eventually come to be known as Gamergate, you know,
So the question, it does say change after the 2010s.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is, so that, I know that's not new, but I think this person has the same disease that thinks Dark Souls 2 was just yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know how to parse after the 2010s on that. Yeah. We had a long discussion about this where I said, I'm not a fan of Dark Souls and the way we're defining it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
It's a thing. I have definitely noticed a change in it. Mm-hmm. Part of it is just people being, you know, more people online, as a thing. A lot of it is the youngs being online.
Yeah.
Not exclusively, but a lot of times it's a young person thing. Like, if I was young and there was a way to be like, I love They Might Be Giants and join a bunch of people who also liked it, I might do it. Mm-hmm.
It's not just the youngs now. Like, oh, you have to be born after 9/11 for this to work for you. It kind of always has been young people, right? Like, think about like Tumblr, like how much it was just like, I'm getting annoyed at this person. They're likely literally a teenager.
That's an interesting thing about that, right? Like, so that is true. A lot of the time, mm-hmm. but it's not true all of the time. One of the things I was watching a video about the Tumblr Snape wives, which are women who say that they are spiritually married to Professor Snape from Harry Potter.
Severus Snape, the potions teacher.
The potions teacher who and that their husbands are being possessed by them or that they wait for their husbands to leave. And they're all like 45-year-old ladies.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's not just young people. Sometimes older people get into it too. Mm-hmm. It's more that it's, you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, they can just be, you have to consider the fact that maybe they're just a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, but they can also, there's a very good chance they're like old enough to rent a carpet shampooer. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're still kind of doing this stuff.
It's enough of the time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like just ends up being a factor that you cannot make the assumption that they're old enough to know better, I guess would be a way to put it.
Fandom kind of is one of these things that I don't really notice or pay attention to. And basically, I only start defining something as fandom when it goes bad.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Like the second, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I hide a carton of milk in my house, right?
Yeah. You're not going to notice it. Yeah.
I'm not going to notice it until shit's gone real bad. And that's when I, and
you know, you haven't noticed the one I put there yet.
Yeah. Yeah. That was only a couple of weeks ago. We have a long way to go here.
Well, I put it in a place that's really surprising too. Like ooh. it's in a way that's going to preserve it, but not as much as a refrigerator would.
Oh, so you're talking about,
tricky with it.
So I just need to go check my toilet tank.
No, I mean, you're getting colder. ice cold. It's worth defining what bad is in this kind of thing. Because it's like, a catchphrase I've had for, you know, the entire run of the network is it's okay to be annoyed.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to feel morally guilty for being annoyed at somebody or something.
Yeah.
Annoyance is natural. Like, something does not have to be morally harmful, which oftentimes this is not.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times this kind of thing is harmless. It's just really annoying, and we are exposed to each other's bullshit way more than we're meant to be because of online.
When I'm saying, you know, like, oh, when it goes bad, I'm talking about like if it turns into like harassment campaigns.
Yeah. And right? Absolutely can super go bad. I remember talking to Jeremy about Supernatural and like Supernatural fans harassing the actors' wives.
Yeah.
You know, because they were so wrapped up in the character and how much they think the two characters should be having sex. Mm-hmm. That these two actors who are not supernatural bounty hunters or whatever were not fucking. They actually had wives and stuff because they're just people.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just like, no. That's not going to work. I am this into this. Mm-hmm. I'm mad about it. And like, that sucks. And I do think people have a responsibility for their emotional regulation and how they behave in public. Mm-hmm. That fucking sucks. It can also just be annoying. Mm-hmm. Like, Undertale has not done a lot of harm. But yeah. I do find Undertale like fandom a little bit annoying. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's like a lot of big titty pictures of that goat lady. I think it's a little bit annoying.
Yeah.
It's weird to me. It just kind of puts me off my beer. It's not harmful. Yeah. I just find it a little bit obnoxious. And I don't think that I am a fan of anything to the degree to which I dive into that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. There are many, many things I like. A lot of the things I like don't have a fandom like that. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them do. Right.
Yeah.
But there's not like an REM fandom that is about like big titty stipes or like harassing those dudes' wives. You know, there's not a Disco Elysium fandom. Like there's fan art and stuff, but there's not it hasn't gone into a harmful zone. And the kind of stuff that I find annoying or like a little bit alienating is not huge. It's not a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm. And like this starts getting into like, you know, just the part of the Souls community that we do not engage with.
Yes.
You know, like we ended up being really lucky because we just attracted people who are like us, you know?
Really lucky. Like we managed to you know, get a big break with liking Dark Souls and thinking about it a lot without doing any of that.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people did. Like a lot of people, you know, who have pivoted, like, and we just managed to sustain, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very grateful for it because that was the blueprint, was to become a fan and be like, I am a fucking fan. I'm catering to fans. Mm-hmm. You know, you are a fan. This is a fandom. You know, fandom doesn't, there's like capital F fandom and lowercase f. We're not just talking about people who like a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fandom means something.
Yeah. You know, thinking about that is like, that's more of just like a straight up like gamer thing to me.
Yes.
Like, okay, you're in an online space. There is a permission structure around the way you are, the way that you are quote allowed or slash even expected. Nobody expects better of you to behave in somebody's comments or in somebody's, you know, DMs, right? Yeah. You know, leads to people being harassed, like, you know, get good.
Even if it's not harassment, even if it's not so, you know,
not
as loaded, not as severe, just being an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of antisocial behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as a thing. Like, I'm glad we missed that. And I am not susceptible to it. Mm-hmm. When we talk about like mouthwashing and something that I think about a lot, because I'm me, is that because I am online more than is healthy for Gary, there are things that I just find annoying because they're alienating and weird to me. And that's what the mouthwashing thing was to me.
Yeah.
Like Liv and I will watch every once in a while, like put on like compilations on YouTube of cosplay because I like cosplay, looking at the craft. Yeah. I think it's cool. The number of just like sexy mouthwashes or shipped up mouthwashes with the traumatic subject material felt like a huge clang to me.
Yeah.
The idea of taking this character who is explicitly a victim in this very tragic story and then being like shipping them with somebody else felt super weird to me. Mm-hmm. Is it harmful? Not really. It's just weird and kind of annoying.
Yeah.
Like I don't, you know, I don't want to, I guess I am yucking somebody's yum with that, but I don't know where else to put that feeling. Mm-hmm. The feeling's big enough where I'm like, yeah, that feels weird. I can't square the circle. It's a knot I can't untie.
Yeah. So like, I think it gets into, again, just drawing bounding boxes around things. It's like fandom, and then the expected activities that it entails. So like enacting fandom, you know, for me, it's like for Silent Hill, you know, oh, I'll pay attention to stuff about Silent Hill. I will, you know, play whatever game of those comes out. I will talk to other people who like Silent Hill.
I'll take you further than that. You'll look at like fan art or something. Somebody shows cool art. You'll buy a plush.
Yep.
You know, like you buy merchandise.
Yeah.
You go to a panel where the people, you know, voice actors talk.
Yes. Yeah. Like I will do those things, but I will not do the kind of like default assumed, like actions or activities, that are associated, you know, with fandom as we are talking about it, the shipping and the whatnot, just like huge vibes. Like, it's weird that of all the shows, King of the Hill kind of nailed this particular problem really, really well in the episode where Peggy gets a lawn gnome.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. She puts out a lawn gnome, and this other, you know, this lady who's like jogging says like, "Oh, you're into gnomes," and then starts like dropping all this lore on her, and saying like, "Oh, this, you know, he should be facing north so he can, you know, gather moss and give him dandelion wine or whatever." And there's like, "Oh, yeah, I didn't realize that there was so much about having a lawn gnome, you know, that it was so deep." And then the woman asks, "Well, do you like Babylon 5?" And Peggy's like, "No, should I?"
Yeah. That's great. Very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that that depth of interaction model with things. One of the reasons why I think that is true, something I associate sometimes with people who are in capital F fandoms is in a non-qualitative way. They're really deeply into something, but they're maybe don't have as wide a variety of things that they're into. Like there's games that I really love, but I can't love them at the expense of all other things.
Yeah.
You know,
of
all other things. I don't have time to get that into gnomes, you know, or get it, you know, because I'm into lots of stuff. I like the X-Men. I'll read X-Men comics. I'm looking at some little X-Men statues, but I'm not so deep into it that like there are people who are historians, there are people who get tattoos, there are people who go all out, there are people who get romantically involved with like phantom rogues and stuff like that. I can't write fiction about them. I can't get to that level of depth because I like other stuff. Other things are taking room up in my heart.
Something I want to address here is like the stuff that we are identifying as being the parts of fandom that, you know, don't really stick out to us. Like it's primarily women who do them.
Yes.
I
don't know where to put that. I don't feel a responsibility to like it because it's feminine coded.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like I want to be careful about what I say because, you can really throw yourself into a, oh, just say you hate women because you don't get something. Which yeah, is like, no,
that's specifically like that. What I'm not saying. I just wanted to point it out because...
No, it's true though. It's also, I'll throw another, like, you know, it's also things that tend to be neurodivergent.
Mm-hmm.
These are things heavily associated with the autism spectrum all mm-hmm. the time, like deep fandoms. I'm not talking about those. I'm just expressing that I don't feel the same way. There's a disease that online brings where you have to react to everything.
Yeah.
And it's so deeply ingrained in me, and I would love to kill it. Like, if I mm-hmm. could just push a button and get rid of something in me,
yeah,
that might be it, other than all the hidden diseases inside me. If it's a mental thing to get rid of in me, like, mm-hmm. it's not a health thing, I would get rid of the thing that makes me feel like I have to have a reaction and comment on everything I see.
Yeah.
This is something that does not hurt me. It's fine that it's for women. It makes sense that there are things that are feminine-coded. Like, otherwise, there's not a difference between genders, right? Like, mm-hmm. it makes sense. There are things that are masculine-coded and feminine-coded. Mm-hmm. That's just the state of the world.
Yeah.
You know? And it's okay for me to be like, no, I don't really get fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to read it. It's not for me. It's not my thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't have anything to do with whether I think about women, because I have more in common with women than not.
Yes.
You know, like, we can focus on the fact that, like, I don't like fan fiction, or you can focus on the fact that, like, the women I know all like the same kind of jokes I do, and we get along and have tons of laughs mm-hmm. and talk about stuff that we like. You know, we don't spend our time doing that shit.
I know lots of women who don't like fan fiction, myself included.
Yeah, of course, right? Like, that's it's this thing I hate about internet. Like, this kind of, like, when something becomes identity driven, you know, this kind of corresponds with fandom. Something becomes mm-hmm. identity kind of attached. Anything less than praise for that thing becomes condemnation of that identity.
Yeah.
And that's just dumb. Like, that's just not how it works. You mm-hmm. know, that doesn't make any sense. One doesn't follow the other.
Yeah.
You know? Not saying people can't be misogynistic and use, like, an argument against fan fiction as part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a squares and rectangles. One is not necessarily the other. You need more data points than that.
And thinking about, like, male fandom, but, like, it's kind of a, you know, another part of that, but, like, fandom comes from sports, right?
Yes.
It's like sport, you know, sports and music. You know, I'm a Kiss fan, and that has, or I'm a Fish fan. That is a, you know, there are certain things that entails. If I like a particular sports team, I have to hate I have to hate entire cities.
Yes. And all the people within.
Yeah.
Teamsmanship, right? Like, I talk about that all the time as a thing I don't like.
Yeah.
Like, don't be on a team and don't hate the same people your team hates.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people and life are too complicated for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in general, if I'm making a bet, like, I'm probably going to get along less with, like, a Republican. I know I'm not going to get along with, like, a fashy, you know, Nazi dude.
Mm-hmm.
That's one pretty far end of an extreme, though.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I mean, and that gets into a whole other thing. Like, Trump literally talks about whether or not people are fans of him or not.
Yes.
Like, there is, you know, when things are reduced to spectacle, you end up with political affiliation expressed by fans. I like the trappings of this. I like the other team losing, et cetera.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, like, there's elements of that I will pick and choose. Like, I do like the other team losing. I like it when bad people have a sad day.
Yeah.
You know, like, I like Dan Bongino being not believing that he had to go into an office and then that make him quit his job. Like, oh man, there's four walls and a door. I can't handle this.
I have to spend all this time away from my wife. Like, job. That's how most people live, actually.
It's a job, brother. Yeah. Uh-huh. That kind of thing I do think is funny, you know, but I'm not, I don't know. I'm not going to get so into it. And I don't necessarily hate every single person who has any single thing in common. Like, the example I come up with, we were talking about recently, is like cops. Like, we were talking about that on a show recently. Like, I probably not going to get along with most cops. I've met cops that are fine, though. Mm-hmm. I would not push a button that kills all cops.
Yeah.
That's silly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's too big of a population to think that there aren't people who are fine in it.
Yeah. And you it's, know? Yeah, that is distinct from a not all cops version of that statement, right? Or, you know, an argument like the not all cops argument is like, well, we can't actually make systemic changes because it's bad apples, blah blah blah.
Yeah, of course, but not like of course we can, you know. It's just it's just dismissing an entire population is a big thing. That requires, that's a huge move and requires a lot of,
yeah,
you know, yeah, requires a lot. I think. It, where it comes into fandoms, I don't know. We got pretty far afield. A little bit. I think I did it too. I think I participated in it. The other thing that comes up a lot with fandoms, and this is a Gary personal thing, and it is just an annoying but not harmful thing that I don't know where to put it. It's kind of related to fan fiction, is how unrelentingly horny a lot of the fandoms are. That came up with mouthwashing as well. Mm-hmm. Mouthwashing felt like a deeply sexless game to me.
Yeah.
The sex in that is used for trauma and terror. That made me feel gross. And the idea of somebody being like, oh yeah, but what if?
Yeah.
Weirded me out. And that part, it doesn't hurt anything. It's fine for people to be kinky and freaks and stuff. Mm-hmm. I support them. It's just a weird, it goes back to me, in a perfect world, I wouldn't be exposed to that because there are people I don't have anything in common with. I wouldn't be looking up stuff about this and getting everything about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really internet bad is my feeling on it. Like a lot of harm.
Something that's funny is that, you know, for a while, but like, especially, you know, let's say like post 2010s, like, fandom being like fully incorporated into like the corporate project of an IP.
Yeah.
You know, like either mining fandom for ideas, you know, like we're going to hang out on the Reddit and we're just, we'll pick an ending from what people are theorizing about, or, you know, like working fandom into the PR and especially like anti-PR for something else. Like we're going to set the fans on other people, that is a phenomenon that I think, is present and is incredibly toxic. But also I think that it is like led to, I think it, maybe it's just because of the pool of people I interact with, being a fan of anything bigger than mouthwashing is a deeply shameful act.
Yeah, that's true too. I can't, and for me, I can't erase from myself some like hipster bullshit from that.
Yeah.
For me, like that is a thing that I do. Mm-hmm. It's the interesting thing about the working fandom into a marketing strategy thing. I remember somebody on the Slack, I was bemoaning a very anonymous like JRPG cover or a visual novel cover that just had a bunch of people exploding out of it.
Yeah.
Like a bunch of them do. And they told, you know, they had worked in localization, like lived in Japan, and said, no, this is on purpose. The reason why these games all have like 13 characters and they conform to these archetypes is for fandoms. There are people who are going to glom onto a white-haired stoic sword maiden. Mm-hmm. So when we have a character with white hair, they are a stoic sword maiden, and we are putting that character in this to put something there for that person.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately because we want to sell stickers and action figures and statues and stuff of that person in addition to, you know, to a degree, tell our story about it. Mm-hmm. And like, so that idea, it's not just like a 2010s thing. It's really ancient.
Yeah.
As this, like, we have to put in the thing for the fandom as a thing. And it really feels anti-art to me.
Yeah.
Like, not that everything that has 13 characters and one of which is a stoic sword maiden is anti-art, but like the impulse feels anti-art to me as a thing. And that kind of coincides with a lot of when somebody does something intentional, like same thing with picking an ending from Reddit, or choosing, you know, your cast or anything like that based on what's marketable.
Yeah.
It grosses me out.
Mm-hmm. Like back to the identity part of this too, like making it a part, making it a part of you. I don't know. It is hard for me to separate that from the, you know, people who will never, ever drop Harry Potter, no matter what.
Yeah.
And what they cling to is, oh, it was part of my childhood. Right. Yeah. And that is a whole other discussion, but I think that it needs to be like linked there. Sometimes it is, you know, you're a fan of something because you're a fan of a sports team because that's what your family was fans of. Right.
That is a true thing. But the thing with that that's interesting is it brings in the factor of like, even if we, without doubting their degree of affection, right? Mm-hmm. Like it has nothing to do with that. It's a thing where it's a rare case where the act of harm is ongoing.
Yeah.
You know, I think most cases that isn't true. Mm-hmm. In this case, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an extremely special case, and it's why I think it's worth focusing on.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about that with one, because it's like, ordinarily, if somebody's, you know, again, fan of Lovecraft, don't like everything he said, don't like all those poems. He's not alive getting my money.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different. As a thing. And I think that's the interesting thing about the J.K. Rowling, like, kind of discourse that has been going around. And it sucks for people I can say my position, but you have more skin in the game. In your position, because like, it's not going to get resolved.
No.
There's not. So, you know, we were talking about this at some point, I think off mic, but I can't remember. But like, it sucks the idea that every single time a new thing comes out about that show, you're going to be trapped in this feeling.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to see people talking on either side of it. There are people who are doubling down. You know, it's not, they'll say it's because it was important to their growing up. They're also just doubling down because now they're on a team.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And then you're going to see Barb's fired. You're going to be in that war no matter what. And like, you have skin in the game, you're in the war, but you have to catch every single part of the war in the entire world. Yeah. Because every time an interview or a new episode of that show comes out, it's just going to be a reset. Mm-hmm. We're going to forget any progress or points. Everyone's going to make the same points again on both sides. Just again.
Yeah.
Forever. Until that show goes away, and then it gets rebooted again because it's been around for a long time. I think that's just reality now. It sucks. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a fix for it.
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't know. It starts getting conspiracy brained for me. It's like, how much of that is like a purposeful part of the marketing? Like, we need to make fans for life. Therefore, we want to like have blowback further entrench them. You know, we need it's the backfire effect.
I don't think that's the case with this. Yeah. I, as somebody who was like around and of the an age to observe the first thing, I think that like a lot of the fandom stuff is super genuine.
Yeah, I think about it now. Yeah.
I don't think anybody is doing that to manipulate. I think they don't need to. I think a reboot that's basically the same thing again was always going to do well because there are people who are not part of this.
Yeah.
Like you know, who don't know about it. It's interesting the way that fandom, how this dovetails into fandom in terms of fandom being about how much attention you pay to something and what approach you take to paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Right. So like there's the meta, like this is all of the stuff with her specifically with JK is stuff that is, you can find it in the work, of course, but it's not immediately evident. A lot of it is stuff from, it's metatextual. It's stuff you're getting from outside of it. So there are people who will pay every bit of attention to the lore of this thing and know every little like house sigil and all that jazz, but will not pay attention to what the person's doing.
Yeah.
Like they're so deeply into the fantasy that they do not care about the real world. That is an expression of fandom, like at its most harmful. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're ignoring context and things that actually exist in favor of like goblin playtime.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have to decide, you know, how much somebody you don't know engaging with that is any of your business and worth your concern, you know, compared
to how much hurt you feel from it. Do you want to let that touch you?
Yeah. Whereas if it's somebody in your life, like you could explain like, hey, you could explain to them because you have a context to speak with them. Like, hey, this is actually having a material harm for me. I kind of need you to decide what do you like more or what do you care about more, continuing to enjoy this thing or me and my rights.
Yeah.
But I don't have anybody in my life like that. So it's not come up. Right.
Yeah. You know, but you are, every time something comes up with this, you are reading the takes of tons of people who do.
Yeah.
Like, it's internet. The problem with this whole thing is internet.
Yeah.
Log off, spend less time online. Hey, man, how's it going? Versus, did you hear this thing? You can spend your time doing anything. Kay and I, we were at a party last Saturday. We sat outside and like chatted with people. It was really great. You can spend your time doing anything.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend it on Blue Sky getting mad. Like, you can't change the thing. You can't. Mm-hmm. This is just what it is. Like, you can't. You can tell your friends, you can tell people personally, but you have to shrink your sphere. Your sphere cannot be the entire world because you can't do it.
Yeah. And somebody, you know, annoying you, unless they are directly coming into, imposing into your world, you can just decide,
Or you can talk to your friend about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'll see something annoying in like a fandom that has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, hey, I saw this thing. Is what the fuck, right? And then somebody will be like, yeah. And then I feel better. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to like impotently put it into a text field. And not get a reply from people who I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have real life friends. I know it's hard to do. It's not easy for everybody.
Yeah.
I'm begging everybody and fandoms, you know, people to get real life friends.
I'm trying.
No, I know you have real life friends. I'm your real life friend. Nick's your real life.
You have plenty of
Yeah. Finally, it can be told. You have real life friends. I'm saying for other people who don't know the alternative. Yeah. To the torture sphere they've decided to put themselves in fandoms.
Yeah. We've said a few phrases of power. I just think about these phrases of power. Like, that's not my business is one of the ones. But the hey man, how's it going? Is one of those. And then one that I think about that goes back to something that you said, which is I don't have to have an opinion about that.
Yeah.
I've had that one for a while, but just like to say, like, oh, I don't have to have an opinion on that. Somebody asked me about it on a show, like it comes up on a, you know, on a topic or whatever. Well, I'll give them their opinion because they asked for it. But yes. Like, no, I don't have to have an opinion about that. Very powerful. Yeah.
The thing that's interesting about, like, I would, you know, I talked about this before, but just saying, I also really try to push that phrase. I love that phrase. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me.
Yeah.
Like, as an opinionated person who does this for his job, it is hard for me not to have an opinion on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I'm desperately working on and would like to.
I don't have to express my opinion about that. Right.
I don't even. Yeah. Also, weirdly separate issues. Like, I don't have to have an opinion versus I don't have to say something out loud that I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not good at that.
Yeah. Same.
You know, I wish I was better at it.
Like, you have these phrases of power.
Mm-hmm. Use them. Mantra.
Use them. Think about them. And it is not just for other people. You know, it is for yourself. It is a reminder. If I get wrapped around the axle or something, I think about, you know, talking to a stranger or talking to an offline friend. And I think about, like, oh, hey, man, what's up?
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So shoot your buddy a text.
Yeah.
Like, I know, just speaking for myself, if somebody was like, hey, get a load of this shit in a text, I would camp out with them for a little bit and share a moment of camaraderie with them.
Yeah.
And every time I've ever done that, it feels so much better than doing it on the internet with strangers. And, like, I don't know, I can get that poison out elsewise as a thing. Hey man, how's it going?
Yeah.
As a thing. And it's also real. Like, it's not only a phrase of power, but it's a fundamentally true thing. Like, you cannot take online discourse and fandom shit offline and be expected to be treated normal.
Yeah.
You know, be treated like you're being reasonable because you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it nobody will understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Every single time I've ever tried to do that with people who are smart and, like, know a lot about stuff, they're just not terminally online. They're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And they're right to do it.
Yeah.
They're right. I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, fandom, it's weird.
Complicated, ties into a whole bunch of stuff. We've been going for about 20 minutes on that.
Yeah, no, this is too long. I didn't mean for this to go as long as it did. Luckily, we don't have that many responses.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. We're gonna move into our responses, of which, as I mentioned, we don't have that too many.
Yeah.
Of us. Yeah. Do you want to get started here with We Love Katamari?
Yeah. So this is a short one, but just echoing something here. Kian says, just a quick note to say that I enjoyed listening to Gary and Liv talking together, and we'd be happy to hear more episodes with Liv in the future.
Thank you. She's in the roster. I also pass on all these compliments to her, and she's been chuffed.
Yeah.
She's been really enjoying it. She felt nervous about it, and she really appreciates it. I've sent her screenshots of people saying nice things just so she knows I'm not gassing her up.
Yeah.
Makes her day. Yeah. So I'm not saying that to do more of them. I'm just saying it's appreciated.
Yes.
Very much so. Yeah. Sam says, For the majority of time with it, I loved We Love Katamari, with its soundtrack of bangers, varied levels, and being able to run over a previously troublesome critter and making it repeatedly pound pavement. The only problem was that I wasn't particularly good at it and often barely squeezed out a win in the time limit, which turns the game's story into a collection of ungrateful assholes looking at the Katamari they asked for with absolute scorn. I can't think of a game that contrasts poppy delight in its levels with abject misery in the results so starkly. You should play some more Rhythm Heaven, which, unless you're incredible at it, you get the saddest, like, dum-dum-dum, okay, thing. Yeah. We talk about this in the episode, but I love a game that is disappointing you. Like, I love that I'm bad at Katamari. Yeah, bronze rank. I love that I'm bad at Katamari, and I know that because the game tells me I'm bad at it.
Mm-hmm.
That is very perverse. That activates my imp gene.
Yeah. I'm bad at Katamari as well.
Few people are good at it. I've watched speedruns of it. It's wild.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Moving on to Dead Space 2 responses, Corey writes, I'm wondering how many replies you've gotten that say, actually, the remake solves all the series problems. And it does definitely turn Dead Space into an actual survival horror game, but it leans much harder into your pitch black anonymous tech corridor complaint.
Is there a remake of Dead Space 2, or is this a response about the first one?
No, no. It's saying like, oh, you have these broad complaints about the series. The remake, you know, took this into account. Maybe if they applied that same ethic to the remake of 2, then it would be be fixed. I played the Dead Space remake. I didn't notice. I didn't notice a huge difference. It still felt very much the same to me.
It's interesting thinking about how many chances you owe something. Yeah. You know, as a thing, like
seen Fatal Frame before. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I always think of that when somebody's like, oh, you didn't play the right version of this or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like how many Halo games do I need to play before I get the lore? You know, and I understand people aren't necessarily doing that to me explicitly, but like, I don't know. I feel like I've given it some chances. Life is short. Corva says, Dead Space 2 was the first horror game I played in earnest to completion. I was probably 14, and at the time, it really blew me away. No specific feelings to recall, but a fun memory stands out. I was sleeping over at a friend's house and brought the game. We stayed up late, passing the controller back and forth. At some point, he approached a locked door, and upon turning around, was met with complete darkness, save two glowing red eyes. It roared. He screamed. In his terror, he flew back, toppled out of his chair, kicked a window on his way down, and then ran out of the room as fast as he could. I was crying laughing. The game may not be perfect, and I haven't revisited it in years, but that sticks with me. Plus, it helped me start playing more horror games. I'll chalk that up as a win. Love y'all's coverage. Thanks for the show. P.S. My wife introduced me to a new phrase people are saying online. When something is copied, but not particularly well, it's called reheated nachos. Dead Space reheated RE4's nachos. All the same ingredients, but now it's soggy and just doesn't taste the same.
That's good. I like that as reheated a metaphor. Reheated
nachos is pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big reaction. They kicked out a window. The PTA is disbanded.
Yeah. You know, basically anything with a game that involves another person, like, gets around the criticisms, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, that's going to be memorable. That was a shared moment kind of deal.
Very fun.
Yeah. I'm going to move on to Halo Wars here. I'll read the longer one because you've had two longer ones here. Naveen writes, I'm very excited to see Halo Wars on the WoW upcoming list. I absolutely adored this game, racking up hundreds of hours between the original release and the definitive edition on both online and offline skirmishes. I find that the game streamlined the slow base buildup phase common to many other PC real-time strategy games and placed more emphasis on capturing territory and points of interest, leading to more dynamic changes in momentum throughout a match. That all is to say that base management, turtling, and hurtling balls of death at the enemy base isn't fun.
Turtling and hurtling.
But Halo Wars finds a different gear in the real-time strategy space that resonated with me. As a Halo spinoff, I felt that it was near perfect. Certainly, the game makes good Halo noises, and and the well-constructed campaign gets into some deep lore that us novel defenders ate up. But more fundamentally, what makes this a great Halo game is by adhering to the less is more design ethos. Like how Halo's two-weapon restriction and slower pace created a unique combat sandbox, so too does Halo Wars' simplified control scheme and streamlined unit economy lead to a game that is more concerned with true skirmishing, while the StarCrafts of the world get bogged down into micromanaging units and large-scale battles. Both can be great in their own way, but only one has an all units button.
It does say all units quite a lot.
Yeah.
The idea, like, restrictions as an inherent advantage is such an interesting thing. Like, after we did this game, I was talking to the Discord about Halo generally.
Yeah.
And seeing a lot of, you know, people going to bat for the series in general, which I'll admit, I've only played two side entries of. I've read about Halo, though, you know, but I was not there for it.
Yeah.
And, like,
ODST plays a lot like Halo.
That's my understanding. People have told me it doesn't, but I feel like, you know, I'm not sure about that, but like, I don't like a two weapon limit. Mm-hmm. I think it like, and I can articulate why it does feel like streamlining, but there's just kind of like two ways of looking at it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, sure, it does make a combat sandbox, you know, like it does make a way where it's like, you have to make a choice. But like a thing that I remember from ODST was you would get the weapon that was correct for the area right before you went into it.
That is the problem with the two weapon limit. Yeah.
So it's still you having all weapons. It's just the game telling you this is the one to use for the section. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the kind of a less is more design thing feels like trickery to me, mm-hmm. like a way to make something seem deeper than it is. But I think I'm willing to just admit I don't get Halo. I don't understand it. I don't understand what's good about it.
We had two full episodes about it.
Yeah, I don't understand Halo. Mm-hmm. Lore seems bad. Games don't seem anything special. While Halo Wars, for adapting an RTS to a console, did a really good job of that. Mm-hmm. A lot of impressive design work in that sphere.
Yeah.
Steven says, and I think Steven sponsored this. Not 100% sure.
I can take a look at that.
Yeah, I'll read this. You can verify if I'm giving false valor.
It is a Steven. I don't know if it is this Steven.
I think it is this Steven. If I'm stealing valor, I apologize. A Steven says, Halo Wars will always have a special place for me, reminding me of a simpler time when I had no responsibilities and starting a trend of enjoying B to C grade games they usually gloss over. As somebody who is in the pocket for everything Halo, getting this for my 15th birthday really opened my eyes to genres of games that I wasn't aware of besides Whitey Guy Shoot Good. It's Guy Whitey Shoot Good. The basic combat triangle of units plus specialized counter units and each leader with unique units offered me dozens of hours of skirmishes against bots and a spark of competitive play against other people that slowly faded over time. I know it may not be everyone's cup of tea, but I hope you had some fun with what I think is a perfectly cromulent RTS. I would agree. It is a perfectly cromulent RTS. If I had never played RTSs before, I wasn't an RTS fan, I would have eaten this up, probably.
Yeah, this would have been a wonderful on-ramp, I think.
Yeah. And it still probably exists as such. Like if I wanted to explain an RTS to somebody mechanically, this would be a good game to do it.
It's a little bit like just explaining first person, video games by giving somebody Portal, like maybe not the entire thing, but like going through the test chambers. Like, okay, I understand. Yeah.
Low stakes, but it teaches you about this movement model.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does Stefan say?
Do we want to put these behind after the admin?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because it's a new game. Yeah.
Sure. Admin, we like you. Patreon.com/DuckFeedTV. That's part of admin. Mm-hmm. Thanking Gwen, that's part of admin. Ratings, reviews, that's part of admin. But we all know what you're here for. Mm-hmm. You want to hear... be reminded about what's happening in May and told what's happening in June.
Yes. So a reminder about May's games, The Last Spell, Rimworld, and Rage is our premium game.
Mm-hmm. Excited about all of that. Mm-hmm. And the June we're announcing here. First episode, it is me. It is Kay. We're going to the best arcade on the West Coast, and we're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I had an idea for a framing of this. Okay. Just one of the things. What are the weirdest games we could find? Mm-hmm. And this thing, like the strangest arcade games we actually got a chance to play.
Yeah.
You know, and could actually talk about it. I don't know exactly what that episode's going to look like. Mm-hmm. But we live here now. We have access to this arcade. We're both here together. We want to do more stuff together. It's been a minute since we've done an arcade episode.
Yeah.
So a little different than the show and tell ones we used to do. I'm probably not necessarily going to beat every arcade game we talk about.
God, no.
I want to play some weird shit and talk about it. And basically... keep trying to get an endorsement with Next Level because it is the best arcade I've ever been to.
It is a magical place.
Yeah. After that, we have a sponsored episode here from, it's Loop Hero is the game we're doing. Something that's been on our list for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about Loop Hero.
Me as well. And then our premium episode for June is going to be Baby Steps. I adore this game. I have not beaten it, but it is incredibly thought provoking.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I was not expecting to like it because I've bounced off of a lot of Bennett Foddy stuff. I played a little bit Duckstream and it was really fun. Yeah. And seeing that it's actually weirdly kind of a friendly Bennett Foddy game.
Yeah.
Like I was watching Will play it a little bit and Will is like, I'm going to do all the challenging things because that's why I like to play video games. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to walk up the man breaker or whatever the thing is at the end of this game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Life is too short, but I bet you I will have a lot of fun just doing the game as it is. I'm excited to talk about it. And it's funny.
Yes. Very funny.
Yeah, a very funny game. Mm-hmm. Not both in terms of slapstick and the writing.
Yes.
If you have things to say about that, June 15th, duckfeed.tv/contact. If you have things to say about Maze Games, that's duckfeed.tv/contact by May 15th. Mm-hmm. Do it.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on the Patreon for Dispatch, for next month's Dispatch as well. That's where we get these questions from.
Yes. Yeah. And join us in thanking our producer, Gwen. Thank you, Gwen.
Big thanks to Gwen. And we'll see you next week with the last spell.
All right. Now we can do Resident Evil 9 responses.
Yeah. So if you're still here, we're going to tell you all the secrets.
Yeah.
I was going to reveal actually something from later in the year, but then I was like, I don't want to be cute, tired. What does Stefan say?
Stefan says, hi there. I almost never write in, but you two are playing not one, but two games that I've actually played recently. Wowza! The other one is The Last Spell. I played through Requiem and really enjoyed it, but had two main complaints. First, the Grace/Care Center section was, to me, the highlight of the entire game, and it's in the first one-third. You start so depowered and slowly build up your skills and crafting, all while exploring a place that, to me, rivals the RE1 mansion or the RE2 police station. I wish it had ended as strong as it started. Second, I'm curious about your opinions here. I felt the return to Raccoon City got a bit underwhelming because of how monocolor and bland the environments were. It was full of fun Easter eggs, and the wireframes of each encounter were great. Those glass window floors, the mortars! But the color scheme was boring, and the whole area lacked any visual flair. I honestly thought that the return to the police station, which should have had me misty-eyed with joy, just fell flat due to how bland it was. Did it do justice to its lineage there, in your opinion? And they say some very nice things, but we'll focus on the game responses.
Yeah, good on you for your nice things. Good job, brother.
Yeah.
It worked for me. The color scheme did not bother me because I recognized enough of the spaces. So it felt like a recontextualized thing.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I mean, we talk about it in the episode, but the return to Raccoon City really worked for me.
Yeah.
As a thing.
What's funny is I feel the monochrome criticism of the first part of the return to Raccoon City. Mm-hmm. You know, when you are basically everything between the web spinner and
the three dungeons.
Yeah, like the three dungeons part. I think that could have used much more visual variety or identity to it. I felt like the police station itself, the monochromeness didn't bother me there because it kind of wasn't that monochrome. It was just not lit. And I like seeing it ruined and sapped of life.
Yeah, it's to a purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, when something gets exploded with a thermal bomb or whatever, a bunch of dust gets on stuff. Dust do be a color.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of necessary to what was happening in the plot. I wish there was a little bit more visual interest. Like the thing with the windows, the sideways building was the coolest visual thing. More of that would have been neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. But it did work for me overall. Axel says, greetings from Sweden. Hello. It's my first time writing in. I got into Resident Evil partly due to your kind words about the franchise. Sans RE4 Remake, this was the first time I played a new RE game as it was released. I've struggled between what I prefer from those games in the series, given how much I enjoy both survival horror-focused games, as well as my love for Resident Evil 4 action horror. When the game was first announced, the dual focus seemed like a no-brainer to me and something I would love. In practice, I think both campaigns are very high quality, and I love how different segments interweave with each other. From a structural perspective, the longer sections of the Care Center and Raccoon City made sense, but I preferred the quick cuts between Grace and Leon since the pacing variation was so enjoyable. I think an interesting thought experiment would be how to execute this style going forward with even more characters in a Magnolia or Pulp Fiction style entry, where everything builds up to one finale. I recognize this desire may only be my own, and would like to know if you like this shift perspective focus, or you want something more singular like RE7 or separate like RE2. Thank you both for your content over the years. Bonus note, I had not played any RE games with Wesker as a present character, a Cardinal Skin I know. Thus, when Zeno showed up, I thought it was Wesker, and that Zeno was just a contextual nickname for a funny meme man that I had seen previously. After realizing it was an entirely new character, I felt kind of stupid, but thought it was funny and worth sharing nonetheless.
A lot of us thought that he was Wesker at first.
Yeah. Wesker got hit in the head and forgot how to wear coats.
Yeah.
And this is Wesker post-coat virus.
Coat Veronica.
Yeah, Coat Veronica. Yeah.
Yeah. So don't feel too bad about that. I think they're absolutely playing with that intentionally. Yeah. Like, as far as the interleaving goes, something that I missed in the last half, or at least in the Raccoon City portion, is like, it's cool in the care center when Leon goes through the same spaces that Grace does, except with his, you know, with his genre, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he gets to some places where Grace doesn't, but like, you can go around and like clean up things that Grace didn't.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to do like the Raccoon City, specifically the RCPD stuff, as Grace. But I think that we didn't get that. And then when you get to the arc, I believe it's the arc. When you get there, like, you have two separate sections of the place and ne'er shall the two meet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 It's I would like to see it as an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that they've wanted. They've played footsie with a lot, I think.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of that with how you can separate out your characters in Zero. There's a little bit of that on a smaller time frame than just bisected in RE6. You know, mm-hmm. since it's broken in a third, so the section's going to be smaller.
Yeah.
They did in Village, they also have, there's great differences in length.
Yeah.
So you don't intersperse it, but it's like you do something that's more integrated, and then you do Benvianto. And it's just a horror haunted house.
Yeah.
Escape room. And then you go to something else really quickly. Like, having shorter increments between different gameplay modes is something they are clearly interested in.
Yeah.
I would like to see a Magnolia mm-hmm. version of that. I think that's an interesting way to do it.
Yeah. I didn't think about the tapes in RE7 as being like that either.
Yeah. So yeah. There's kind of moves towards that. Mm-hmm. I would definitely give them, like, let them give it a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah. They've inspired confidence in me.
Yeah, they basically earned my checkout. Yeah, I'll check it out. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We already did the admin.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.